This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 3rd of January. The British government presses ahead with plans for a national care service by announcing a commission of inquiry. It'll be the third in three decades. What are the chances that it'll fare better than the previous two? Sir Ed Davey, whose Liberal Democrats focused their general election campaign on social care, is with us to discuss how to make it deliver. Concerns over the welfare of those sleeping on the streets as temperatures plummet around Britain. Why does a bereaved killer whale propel her dead calf through the open seas for thousands of kilometres? We mark your card on the cultural highlights of 2025. And Luke Littler, teenage darts prodigy on the cusp of global success Friday night. Did he or didn't he? Nigel Farage, the leader of Reform UK, has tonight delivered a rebuke to Elon Musk over his support for Tommy Robinson, the name by which the far-right activist Stephen Yaxley Lennon likes to be known. Mr. Musk used X, his social media platform, to call for Robinson to be freed from prison, where he's serving 18 months for contempt of court. Nigel Farage and Elon Musk have found common cause recently in their mutual allegiance to Donald Trump, sharing time at Mar-a-Lago and being photographed together. Asked about the post, Mr. Farage described Tommy Robinson as not what we need for a party aiming to win the next general election.
He's not somebody that I want in my political organisation. He's a campaigner. He does his own thing. He gets some things right. But very often, I don't approve of somebody who's been to prison on five separate occasions.
Mr. Farage, one of five Reform MPs returned at the last general election, is holding a conference in Leicester this weekend. Interviewed by the BBC's East Midlands Today, Mr. Farage said Elon Musk hadn't given Reform UK any money yet, but he's minded to give us some money if there's a legal way to do it. Well, our political correspondent Hannah Miller has been watching Mr. Farage's speech this evening. Hannah, he and Tommy Robinson have history.
They absolutely do, Sean. Yes, it was back in 2018 that Nigel Farage resigned from his then party, UKIP. At the time, he said that it had become obsessed with supporting Tommy Robinson, who he condemned then as being entirely unsuitable for party politics. I think the key to understanding this is recognising that Nigel Farage wants and indeed needs wide appeal if he's to win more seats. And he believes that associating with someone who has a criminal record, who's been sent to jail on multiple occasions, isn't helpful for that cause. We understand there have been some conversations going on suggesting to Trump supporters in America not to jump on board with this Tommy Robinson campaign, Nigel Farage suggesting that Elon Musk may have misunderstood the circumstances of Tommy Robinson's imprisonment. That said, he's still describing Elon Musk as a hero. Mm. He's not going to create too much distance at a time when there may be that prospect of money to be had as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation about that at Westminster, isn't there? Perhaps a tinge of envy as well?
Perhaps. I'm not sure I would say envy. The association with Elon Musk carries some political risk, I think. But of course, all the parties would like more money, and Reform at the moment have the momentum in terms of support, and with that momentum comes more money. As you said earlier, Musk is said to be minded to give a donation if it can be done legally. And last month, there was this photo that Nigel Farage put out of himself and the party treasurer, Nick Candy, standing alongside Elon Musk, all of them standing in front of a photo of Donald Trump. It was clearly staged to send a message. If Elon Musk had managed to help Donald Trump win the US election, Nigel Farage wants not just his money, but also his tactics, because he ultimately wants to win the next election here in the UK.
Just a last thought, Hannah. Mr. Farage says Reform's ambition is to go from the current five seats out of 650 to forming the next government. Yet he spent much of his time not on attacking the government, but attacking the Conservatives. Why?
Yeah, he's got his eyes in both directions at the moment. And for what it's worth, I think Labour and the Conservatives both know it. He is planning on going to Kemi Badenoch's constituency, making that a target for the next election. I think he feels that if he can sort of create some more fear within the Conservatives, that is the division and the fear within the party is helpful. He wants more defections like that of Marco Longhi, the former Conservative MP who has announced that he's now supporting Reform tonight. But he is also attacking Labour very strongly too. He's talked about their policies on winter fuel, raising taxes on farmers, So he's got his eyes in both directions.
Hannah Miller, our political correspondent at Westminster. Thank you. The Health Secretary for England, Wes Streeting, has announced the first steps towards creating a national care service, starting work in the spring under the leadership of Baroness Louise Casey. An independent health commission will deliver its final report in 4 years' time. Mr Streeting told Today that time frame was needed.
We will have cross-party talks next month, and I'm really encouraged by the fact that since the election, the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats and Reform have also, they want to work cross-party on this. Talks will begin next month. We will work on the setup of the commission. We will work throughout the commission. And I hope that when the commission reports and ahead of the next general election, we can all agree on the direction on social care for the long term.
By Streeting, that could be the triumph of Mr Streeting's hope over his predecessor's experience. The Casey Commission will be the third independent commission on social care reform in England to be created in less than 30 years. It follows the Royal Commission on Long-Term Care for the Elderly, completed in 1999. Some measures were accepted, but the key proposal, free personal care for those aged 65 and over, was rejected. In 2010, on coming into government, the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition established the Dilnot Commission to examine how to deliver what it called a fair, affordable and sustainable funding system for social care in England. The Dilnot Commission's key proposals, among them a cap on people's lifetime liabilities for personal care, were accepted and enacted in the Care Act 2014. However, despite successive governments promising to introduce versions of the Commission's proposals, the plans have all been dropped, most recently by Mr Streeting and his Cabinet colleagues, who accused the Conservatives of not having budgeted for them. Deborah Crisp is both wife and daughter of people with care needs. She lives in the southeast of England. When we spoke this evening, I asked first how she'd felt when she heard Mr Streeting's announcement.
Well, my heart sank. I mean, to be fair, with two close family members with dementia and needing social care, my heart doesn't raise very high on most days, but it sank today. I could not believe the time frame was being extended to that length.
The government says it needs to do that to get a consensus. I mean, from where you're sitting at the moment with, as you say, your husband's needs and also your mum's, do you feel that getting a consensus is important?
I think it is, but I don't want them to hide behind it. I mean, there have already been three goes at looking into it. I mean, we had the one that was called the death tax, we had the dementia tax, then we had the cap that was discussed, but Labour didn't implement that. I think they could use some of the information they have to move a little faster, ask more people, you know, ask care homes, ask families, anybody, ask people who are needing care themselves and implement what they can when they can. I do feel that it is a broken system, and even if it's only partially fixed until a complete solution is found, I think something needs to be done.
Tell us about your situation.
Well, my mother has dementia and she is a self-funder because she owned her own property. The money from her property went, so all that money was spent on being in a care home. My husband has Alzheimer's. We're getting further into the journey now. If the decline is similar this year to last year, then at some point this year towards the autumn, we will need to sell our house because we will be self-funders too. We don't have the savings for the amount of money it costs for a care home each month. And I will have to find somewhere else to live. And the other half of the money from the house will go towards funding his care.
Do you think that's fair enough or not?
I suppose it's very difficult because it is expensive. I don't feel that all of the money should be paid for if you do have assets or a property. I think that a cap is the best deal. It would mean not worrying that if he lived longer, the money that we had would not run out like it did for my mum. There would be enough money for me perhaps to stay where I am. I've lived here all my life. It will be a big change for me if I have to move somewhere else.
Is part of the problem here the uncertainty? In other words, you don't know whether or not actually you might be able to stay in your house. So you might go ahead and buy something and then find actually after the event you could have stayed. For example, and I wouldn't wish this for you, but if, say, your mother and your husband died unexpectedly,
then I would be able to stay in my house. It's not a planned move.
No.
It's an enforced decision.
I ask the question because I wonder if that's part of the problem here, the uncertainty of all of these things.
It is. You really do not know what you're dealing with because you don't know how long. I mean, this was the problem we had with mother. I mean, mum should be 99 in a couple of months and she has multiple health issues. So we didn't think that maybe she would outlive the money. And unfortunately, my husband does have to go into care. I don't know how long it will be for. I don't know if it will be 2 years, 4 years, 8 years. I have no idea. It's so hard to plan when you have so much uncertainty around.
And uncertainty, too, as to what role and how much the state will contribute.
I mean, the state doesn't really contribute anything if you're a self-funder until you get down to the £23,000 limit as the years go by. Care home fees do not stay the same. As you say, it's awful saying it, terrible saying it. If somebody lives longer and the fees go up, the money that you have thought would be sufficient may not. So it's this constant, what do we do? Will there be enough? What will happen when that money goes? It's a lot of stress. When, to be fair, I think they are some of the most stressful illnesses anyway. It just adds that other layer on top.
Did you have any expectations with the change of government about what might happen with social care?
I did. I really did. I hoped they would grasp the nettle. I think it needs to be dealt with by them all, to be honest. It cannot be used as a political football. They think it's maybe too big a problem and don't really know where to start.
That was Deborah Criswell. The leader of the Liberal Democrats, Sir Ed Davey, has declared himself bewildered by the government's timetable for a national care system. He's in our radio car now. So, Ed, good evening to you and a happy new year. Why do you think this timetable is too protracted?
Well, good evening, Sean, and happy new year to you. Mainly because we've been around this track so many times before. And there's a crisis in our social care system, which then impacts on the NHS. So we need far more urgent action. What Liberal Democrats have said is we need some measures immediately ahead of any cross-party talks, and we set those out in the general election, for example, dealing with the shortage of care workers. And then you need a cross-party commission, because you do need cross-party consensus. And I think that could be done within this year.
Within this year? Really? When
yes,
the party
absolutely.
Seems so far apart?
No, well, listen, as your report showed, and as Deborah, who you just interviewed, said, we had the Dilnot report, we had the 2014 Care Act, as you talked about, we had the Royal Commission back in 1999. And so we know all the issues, we know all the options. Yes, refresh them a little bit and make sure that the reforms you're making to social care are integrated into the reforms you're making in the health service. Really important, that link. But I really don't think we need to wait three more years. That would be, frankly, betrayal of elderly people, disabled people, their families, and also prevent us getting to grips with the crisis in the NHS.
In order to get that consensus then within the year, would you be prepared, for example, to compromise on your commitment in your manifesto to introducing free personal care based on the model introduced when you were in government with Labour in Scotland in 2002?
Well, not before we go into any talks, because we want to make our case. We've come to our policies, ideas in our manifesto after a lot of thinking. And, you know, if I may, the proposal we put for free care for the elderly in our manifesto wasn't just based on experience in Scotland, but also on a House of Lords Select Committee report, which looked into this in huge detail and showed that it was actually a very efficient way of doing it, which would generate billions of pounds of savings for the NHS before the end of this decade. So, you know, actually, one of the reasons we came with our proposals was based on the evidence, based on many previous reports. And I think those ideas should be taken into the cross-party commission that they're talking about.
Let's talk about that evidence then. 23 years ago, that was implemented in Scotland. It hasn't delivered nationally consistent high-quality social care. The quality has varied from local authority area to local authority area, depending on what resources they put in, what care staff was available. As recently as 2021, the then First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, said she would propose a national care service, which incidentally they haven't yet implemented, but she said it would be to end the postcode lottery and care provision. In other words, merely legislating for a right to free personal care isn't sufficient. You have to guarantee the resources.
Well, Sean, of course you're right. It's a question about resources. It's a question about standards across the board, which are kept to at least minimum standards for everybody. So there isn't that postcode lottery, as you say. And that's why, actually, Liberal Democrats have argued for a whole range of measures. We've talked about, for example, addressing the chronic shortage of care workers having a higher minimum wage for care workers.
Having a higher minimum wage depends on resources, and I don't want to slip away from the resources point because it's incredibly important.
Sure.
Is it fair to say to younger working age taxpayers that they should pay more, as they will have to do as the numbers in need grow, as our population on average ages, even though there may be some benefits in terms of improved technology and all the rest of it, which we all hope for? Is it fair to say that to younger working age taxpayers, of whom the numbers are falling, when people in wealthy areas like the ones many Liberal Democrat MPs now represent in Wimbledon, Henley, Chichester, Tame, don't have to downsize their homes? I mean, in a sense, the trade-off now for you has become politically quite awkward, hasn't it?
Not at all. I mean, I go back to what we said 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, actually, in the 2014 Care Act, when following the Dilnot Commission, we said, look, the way to make sure that these costs are shared between individual families and the state is to put a cap on care costs. That clearly is an idea that should go into this commission. It seems to me a very fair way, because it basically says to the individual, yeah, you'll have to pay some of the costs, as Dilnot proposed. But if you're one of those really unlucky ones who ends up needing care for many years, particularly people, for example, who have early onset of dementia, you and your family are not going to be penalised on top of the horrible disease that you got. That seems to me the fair principle that underlay Dilnot. It's a principle that comes from the NHS, and it's a principle that Liberal Democrats have always supported.
Sir Edward Davey, Liberal Democrat MP and leader of his party, thanks very much for joining us on The World Tonight. Coming up before the end of the programme, in the next 20 minutes or so, we hear about some of the films that will be on cinema screens in 2025, including some notable remakes.
A story of love creates a passion, a danger.
So Kiss of the Spider-Woman is getting a reimagining. This is going to be based off of the Broadway musical. This stars Jennifer Lopez in many ways, the role that she's probably waited for her entire career.
Now, before that, 6 years ago, there was fascination among whale watchers over the case of a killer whale pushing the body of a dead newborn calf for more than 1,600 kilometres through the water. Now, the same whale has been spotted doing it again in the Puget Sound off the US-Canadian coastline by Washington State and British Columbia. Anais, Remily is editor-in-chief of Whale Scientists and researches the species at the Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. Thank you so much for being with us on the programme. Tell us about this whale and what's happened to it.
All right. So thank you so much for having me. So this whale, unfortunately, has lost another calf, just like you mentioned. And she has lost it in the last week or so. And she has been carrying it ever since, which is quite heartbreaking to witness. And of course, as humans, we can feel a lot of sympathy with this mother because we have probably met or heard someone going through the loss of a child. And we know that these animals are very social. They can form tight bonds with the members of their pod. And so I do not think it's unrealistic to say that they do feel pain and sadness. And it's incredibly painful to witness that.
The numbers, I mean, obviously, we're talking about this particular whale. Two of her calves have died. I think two have survived, haven't they, over the different pregnancies she's had. But in general the prognosis for killer whale calves is not good. Why is that?
So there are many reasons why killer whales might not make it past their first year. We know that the survival rate in the wild is typically 50%. But in southern resident killer whales, which is the population that Talekua, this killer whale, belongs to, they're having a hard time producing viable calves. And there are many different reasons why that might happen. But three of the main ones could be the fact that they are not having enough food. So the southern resident killer whales feed mostly on Chinook salmon. And we know that other species love Chinook salmon and they're humans.
Yes.
So, of course, there is some competition with humans. There's also a lot of issues with dams being constructed on the rivers that the salmon reproduce in. And so there's a lack of their primary food, which is Chinook salmon.
And boat noise scaring off some of the other fish that they might feed on. And then also the issue, I think, of contaminants getting potentially into the mother's milk.
Yes. So I'm an ecotoxicologist. So mm-hmm. that means I study the pollution inside these animals. And you're very right. These contaminants that we have released a couple decades ago and we're still releasing into the ocean. So these include pesticides and flame retardants. They accumulate inside the fat of the animals. And so when the moms need to make fat-rich milk for their babies so that they can grow healthy and quickly, they unfortunately need to use their own fat to produce this milk. And so they'll pass up to 70% of the contaminants that they have stored inside their fat to their babies. So that can cause a lot of issues with development for the calves, and it can cause some hormonal issues as well, some immune issues. So that is not good news. But we also know that this population is very small, and so there is some inbreeding, unfortunately, which can lead to congenital issues or to miscarriages or premature birth.
Well, let's hope that perhaps she will have future live births and not have to go through this sad ritual once again. Anais Ramili of Vancouver University, thank you very much for joining us on The World Tonight. Now here, the first countrywide cold snap of the winter has brought an abrupt end to the festive mood. Advice to travellers, don't. Advice to the elderly, turn up the thermostat. But what about those who have nowhere to travel to and no thermostat, people sleeping rough? Let's talk to Colin McInnes. He's the founder and chairman of Homeless Project Scotland, whose volunteers are on the streets in Glasgow tonight. Colin, thanks very much for talking to us. I know you're out and about in part of because of the experience your sister had when she was sleeping rough in London some years ago, and you subsequently helped to set up this charity. What do you do on a night like this?
So on a night like this, we have volunteers obviously that obviously take to the streets and street teams. We have also street cycles who take to the streets, and we supply sleeping bags, foil blankets, and any kind of thing to keep you warm, hand warmers, etc. We also have a shelter that's running, so we have a night shelter for homeless people. It's the only night shelter of its existence in Scotland at the moment, and we are able to give people 33 safe warm beds that they can sleep in tonight from 10:30 to 9:30 in the morning.
So you're about to open the doors. How many beds have you got?
At the moment, we have 33 beds for our capacity. Unfortunately, we will see maybe 20 to 30 people being turned away tonight once our shelter's full. But we'll try and obviously make sure that they have everything possible to basically keep the ice on the sleeping bag and not on their body.
Now that's a really interesting point. What can be done? What are the risks?
The risk is death, to be fairly honest.
Yeah.
When somebody beds down in a doorway or on the street or in a bus stop or wherever they're going to bed down for the night, the risk is that they freeze to death, because you can make sure that obviously you can try and get to sleep as warm as you can, but what you don't know is going to happen during the night is obviously the ice is going to cover up you, and you're going to be like an Eskimo.
But even in situations like things you might feel the need to do, like relieve yourself, for example. I mean, even an activity like that could be risky, presumably, when the temperature is like it is now.
Of course. So people don't have access to toilets, they don't have access to washing facilities. Also, if their clothes get wet, that's a major danger, because obviously water turns to ice. And if people's clothes are wet before they go to sleep, then you've got obviously ammonia, you've got pleurisy, you've got things that could set in and kill people. We have woken up rough sleepers before and they've said they can't feel their toes and their toes are black because of the frostbite.
What can you do to try and mitigate it for those who don't get a place in the shelter?
We continue to take people's details. We continue to use the law in Scotland, and the homeless legislation in Scotland is one of the best legislations in the world, in paper and in writing. But unfortunately in Scotland, in practice, it doesn't happen. So we are continuously putting pressure on the ministers, continuously putting pressure on local authorities to say, you have a legal obligation to provide accommodation to these people who are in need of a shelter. So we take people's details, we give them a hot cup of tea, we give them food, and we continue to try and fight and give the voiceless a voice.
Colin McGuinness, founder and chairman of Homeless Project Scotland. Thank you very much for talking to us. And of course, thank you so much for what you're doing out there tonight and on so many nights. It's only the 3rd of January and it could be a long winter ahead. Understandable then that the oldest among us may be worried about the consequences of heeding the advice of Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary for England. He said this was definitely a weekend to turn the heating on. Dr. Jessica Harvey, a GP in Shropshire, spoke to The World at One about the health concerns prompted by the fall in temperatures.
We're all inside more, which means that our germs tend to circulate more, so we're more at risk of catching things. You know, if there's ice on the ground, then people trip, fall. We certainly see a lot more broken hips and broken wrists at this time of year from things like that. Also, those elements are just pure cold injury. People just not managing to keep warm enough.
Caroline Abrahams is the charity director at Age UK. Caroline, thanks very much for talking to us. I know it's a very busy time of year anyway for you, but presumably the cold smack makes it even more so for your volunteers and your staff. Address this question first of all. Why is it so important that older people in particular keep the heating on and keep the thermostat set at a high enough temperature?
Well, good evening. The reason is because as we get older, our bodies find it much harder to adjust to extremes of temperature, whether it's very hot or very cold. And if an older person becomes chronically cold, their blood pressure goes up, and that makes them more susceptible to a stroke or to a heart attack. And if they've got underlying health conditions, as lots and lots of older people do have, then that makes them all the more vulnerable. And if they've got a lung problem, for example, if they've got asthma or COPD, then breathing in that cold air is very bad for them, worsens their condition, can easily lead to the onset of an infection and even to pneumonia.
And those who think, I'll put a few extra layers on, I'll put on a thicker jumper, I'll put an overcoat on top of that, that's what will make a difference, what would you say?
I say that's a great idea, but it's not enough on its own, not when the temperatures are getting to what they are this weekend and what is forecast for the next few days in lots of parts of the UK. It's that cold air that's really bad for you, and becoming chronically cold, trying to live in a really cold home, as some older people have told us they are trying to do. They've been determined not to run their heating because they're worried about their bills. That may be okay when it was mild, but of course that time is gone and we're now into serious winter cold. And so we agree with Wes Streeting. We would really encourage people to run the heating, even if they're worried about the bill. It's better to look after their health and look to see what extra help they could get to support them with their finances. And we're here to help, and so are some other people as well.
And you're able to direct them to the kind of help they can get, both from the energy company, from central government, and from their local council.
That's right. Energy companies are under a duty to support their customers if they're struggling with their bills. That's true of people of all ages, and absolutely, particularly perhaps for older people this winter who are often struggling to come to terms with the loss of their winter fuel payment if they're no longer receiving it, which was an unexpected blow. So yes, they can definitely help. Definitely worth contacting them if you're worried about paying your bill. But also your local council may be running a scheme that could offer you some support. And do get in touch with Age UK, because we can help you see whether you're actually claiming all the financial support you're entitled to. It's not just pension credit, which people have talked about a lot recently because it's the gateway benefit for winter fuel payment. But there are other benefits too that are often underclaimed by older people and can make a real difference.
And there are payments triggered at local level, aren't there? The average temperature in a local area where it's below 0 degrees Celsius or less for 7 days in a row, or forecast to be below freezing for seven consecutive days, you can get payments. I think they've been triggered today in dozens of postcode areas in Cumbria, Northumberland, parts of England in the Scottish borders. That's happened already, and we've got a long weekend ahead, so more may be triggered as well.
Yes, that's true. But I mean, the problem is that even in the areas which aren't going to be as cold as that, actually just pretty cold temperatures in a home are enough to make somebody seriously unwell if they are an older person. So, of course, we worry about those extremes that we've been hearing about, the possibility of a foot of snow in some parts of the country. Obviously a big issue for older people there. But even in places like London, where I live, where it's not going to be as cold as that, it would be very easy for an older person to come to grief if they don't stay adequately warm in their own home.
Caroline Abrahams, Charity Director at Age UK, with some very sound advice there. Thank you very much. Reboots of old ideas somehow never go out of fashion. Beetlejuice was 2024's, but perhaps the less said about that, the better. Anyway, Nosferatu opened on New Year's Day, 103 years after the original, helped set a standard for cinema horror. Snow White will be on our screens again soon, 88 years after she helped to establish Disney's reputation for animation. And The Kiss of the Spider-Woman has been remade after 40 years. James Kumarasamy has been talking to Clayton Davis from Variety magazine about some of the film and streaming highlights of the year ahead, and he asked him what we should expect.
You're going to see a lot of franchises coming back. I mean, Marvel has a good slate, including Thunderbolts, but also we're going to get Fantastic Four, which I think is one of the biggest excitements for superhero fans, not only because it's Pedro Pascal, who is stepping into the lead role of Mr. Fantastic, along with a great cast.
We're also going to be seeing some remakes, aren't we? One that struck us here, the Kiss of the Spider-Woman. I remember seeing the original back in, what was it, the 80s?
It begins with seduction. A story of love creates a passion, a danger.
So Kiss of the Spider-Woman is getting a reimagining. This is going to be based off of the Broadway musical adaptation. This stars Jennifer Lopez in many ways, the role that she's probably waited for her entire career. This is the Sonia Braga role that was made famous in the 80s, and essentially three different roles. And this is something that I think could surprise us in a significant way.
It's a bit like Hairspray, isn't it? Coming a film, then becomes a musical, and then becomes a film again.
I mean, that's where people tend to find comfort. You find comfort in the things that you know. For a marketing department at any type of major studio, that's easier to sell. You know, I mean, that's why we have Wicked Part 2 coming, now titled Wicked for Good, next year. Part 2, and if anyone's familiar with the Broadway show, does run adjacent to the timeline of Wizard of Oz.
You talk about familiar franchises or familiar stories. Snow White is pretty familiar, isn't it? And it's getting an interesting remake.
I think this might be the third or fourth entry of a Snow White universe.
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest of them all?
Fame is thy beauty, Majesty.
And listen, Disney has spent a lot of money on this. Some of those early murmurs don't seem to bring a lot of confidence into what it can actually deliver in terms of box office. You know, the trailer wasn't very well received. I mean, that's kind of what happens when you have CGI dwarves. Those don't really get people excited and in seats. I don't think the story of Snow White doesn't really transcend well into today's cinematic global community.
Let's turn perhaps to the way we watch films, and specifically the streaming platforms, which had a great few years, but then seem to have a bit of a fallow period of late. What's happening there? What should we be expecting in 2025?
It's always good to remind everyone that 2020 was the time that accelerated the conversation that we all were trying to avoid. How can streamers and movie theaters coexist? So I think what we're seeing now is the great reduction, I believe, is still occurring. And when I say great reduction, you know, everyone tried to get into the streaming game because everyone was chasing Netflix. I will say that there will be certain movies that have a harder time getting made.
Yeah, and Netflix, I understand, is going to be diversifying, moving into new areas.
Yeah, I mean, they're moving a lot into live events, American football. They're going to be getting into wrestling. I think in 2026 and 27, they're going to be the official place to watch the Women's World Cup. You know, if content isn't going to be completely the number one driving factor, like in terms of movies, TV shows, then live event space is the next natural go-to for them.
That's Clayton Davis from Variety magazine talking to Jamie Kumarasamy. And I'll say in passing, I saw Nosferatu last night. It's stylish hokum. 17-year-old Luke Littler has won the PDC World Darts Championship at Alexandra Palace in London tonight. In fact, in the last 40 minutes or so, he beat the three-time world champion, the Dutchman Michael van Gerwen, comfortably 7-3. In the process, the teenager became the youngest player ever to lift the trophy. James Gregg was watching as Littler won the title and £500,000.
Luke Littler, who's only missed 5 match darts all tournament long, is potentially looking at a crowning moment here. All these players Dare to dream of darting delight, but this was the moment the boy wonder became a man on the biggest stage with the whole world watching.
Well, also watching was Jenny Phillips. Jenny owns Q and Dart World in South Staffordshire. Evening to you, Jenny. What did you make of it all?
Good evening. Oh, wow, what a match. What a match. We're on the edge of our seats.
Did you have any doubt?
No. We knew Luke had we'd won. There was a one point he, you know, Michael was starting to come back, but we knew Luke could finally get there in the end.
He certainly keeps
all
his
proud.
Cool. He certainly keeps his cool, doesn't he?
He does. Yes, I'm what? Sure. Deep down, he was. There was a little bit of worry there, but no, he was really good.
What impact has he had on your business?
Oh, it's a massive. We're seeing lots and lots of youngsters getting into the sports. Some as young as 3 or 4 are coming into the shop with their parents. So it's, yeah.
Your business is called Q and Dart World. And I mean, has it changed the sort of balance of that business between snooker and pool and darts?
Yeah, it has too since we opened. We were sort of probably about 80% pool and snooker and 20% darts. Brit sort of turns now. We're probably sort of 50-50 at the moment on both.
Really? And that's in the last couple of years? Or?
Yeah, in the last year.
So since he kind of exploded onto the stage with his semi-final appearance a year ago?
That's it, yes. Mm. Yeah, it's gone crazy.
And what little merchandise is there available for youngsters who are fans?
So in store, we've got, for the really young ones, we've got from magnetic boards so they can play alongside the parents and you don't need to worry about all the holes in the walls. but yeah, we've got dart boards, surrounds, mats, darts, flights. There's loads out there at the moment for little Luke.
I suspect sportswear is going to follow not too far down the line. Now he's world champion. What about interest from schools? I think there's sort of some suggestion that maybe some schools in the area are starting to get interested in darts as well.
They are, yes. I think there's quite a few looking to put after clubs on to play darts and leagues and things like that. So, yeah, it's they're every, you know, the whole community is getting into it.
Good for your maths as well, I guess. Yeah, I mean,
very good.
You really do need to be able to do your mental arithmetic, don't you, to play darts effectively?
They do, yeah. I mean, the youngsters nowadays, they just see the numbers and it's incredible.
And you're sponsoring a couple of young players at the moment, I think.
Yeah, we've got Nicholas Ayres, who's the current EPSB under-14s national champion. He's qualified to represent England in the European Championships in Turkey in March this year.
Right.
And we've also got Oscar Newton. He's qualified in 2024 for the England pool team as well.
Jenny Phillips, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations, of course, to Luke Littler as well. Our closing headline on this programme, the Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davey has urged the government to rethink its plan for a commission on social care to take 4 years to take its final conclusions.
We need far more urgent action. What Liberal Democrats have said is we need some measures immediately ahead of any cross-party talks, and we set those out in the general election, for example, dealing with the shortage of care workers. And then you need a cross-party commission, because you do need cross-party consensus.
And that's The World Tonight. Good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice, and for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.